One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three.
If I might say this, please. You recall on yesterday you had referred to a statement that Jimmy Baldwin made.
Yes, yes.
To the effect that the mob did not represent the thinking of a majority of the people in the South. And I answered that question in part by saying, number one, that considering the fact in gubernatorial elections the most extreme candidate on the race issue usually win, with the person we might consider to be the representative of the mob usually gets a majority of the votes and wins. Looking at the Beckwith trial, considering the fact that the governor of the state, Ross Barnett, he walks in, he shakes this man's hand, and there was no hue and cry on the part of any white element in Mississippi about the governor's action. So this is why, in my mind, there's still serious doubts as to whether or not it is not fair to say that the mob represents the majority of the South.
It does represent the majority of the South.
It appears that way. I think there's a great deal of evidence to substantiate that position. Of course, that's not to say that there are not some people in the South who do not go along, but this is the silent element in the South. And if we say that the demagogues do not represent the majority of the Southern people, then we have to then say that the majority of the Southern people are silent.
Yes, we have to say that in any case. Silent or and without leadership.
Right.
I read somewhere, I read a report, as a matter of fact, on New Orleans, advisory report for Civil Rights, Congressional Committee on Civil Rights. In that report, it said that not one leader in New Orleans, one white leader, the white community, showed himself at all on the issue. Except segregationists.
Well, that's not altogether true. I've had personal experience with some white leaders.
Who showed themselves?
Well, it depends on what we mean by who showed themselves.
Yes.
For example, I'm talking about men who went on television after the first school crisis.
Yes.
The following year, they went on television to make appeals for order. In addition, they bought a full-page ad in the newspaper. And the really significant thing about what these people did amounts to nothing more than this. From the day that those men made their appeal on TV, there were no further disorders, which means that the real power, the people with the power structure, they can do anything they want to do. Even though they may be in a minority, when they put the word on the mayor that this isn't to be tolerated, then the mayor tells the chief of police that this riotous conduct is not going to be tolerated, and just like that. So I don't think it's fair to say that they haven't shown their faces at all. They haven't been as vocal as they should have been. I don't think they could not even be considered, well, they are moderates, but they haven't made as much noise as a moderate would be expected to make. Mm-hmm. And behind the scenes, there have been whites in the community who have worked behind the scenes. I've worked with them.
Yes.
I'm speaking now about people from the Chamber of Commerce, people who are presidents of the banks and of the utility company. I have personally met with these people on these issues. For example, one thing that was accomplished, up until this year, if a Negro wanted to become a master plumber, he had to get two master plumbers to sign his application. Well, now, the truth of the matter is there were no Negroes who were master plumbers.
There were no plumbers at all in New Orleans, were there?
No Negroes. Which meant that it was impossible for a Negro ever to become a plumber because no white plumbers were ever going to sign their applications. Well, as a result of the persons that we work with, this changed. Presently, if you want, you can get any two reputable citizens to sign your application if you want to be a plumber.
Has you changed the union regulation on this point?
I'm talking now about the city.
I see.
About the
city
government.
Licensing.
Right, the licensing body. Whether a plumber can join a union or not is a different question.
Now, how much resistance is there to on the union at the union level?
I don't know. This was really, this was not one of our major problems. I just threw that out as an aside.
Yes.
We were negotiating on the question of jobs in city government, the question of firemen, and on the question of garbage men, which may not appear to be significant, but except that there are many Negroes with no skills at all. And this is all they're qualified to do. We were negotiating on the removal of signs in City Hall and in other public buildings. So this was just an aside. The chairman of this branch of government was in the meeting. He said, well, here's what I've done to indicate my good faith, you see. So I have never made a thorough analysis. But now these meetings were precipitated by the people who control the majority of the wealth in this city. However, any time the mayor went back on his word, they would not join us in any attack. For example, the mayor put this in writing. I wish I had a copy of it here, but I was present. The mayor stated that the signs would be removed from all of the public toilets. And the truth of this was 3 or 4 months ago. Now, this was in August. And the truth of the matter is the signs are still up. Right this minute, some of them are down, but for the most part, they are still up. So now when we went back and said, well, now you didn't carry out with your agreement, and then he just hedged, and we threatened demonstrations, he continued to hedge. And he really hasn't, he's lied outright, there's no other way to state it. And as a result of the mayor's position, we have not been able to get any more fruitful negotiations going, which means that I can predict here that before summer, or not later than summer, you will have major demonstrations in New Orleans. As a matter of fact, New Orleans will be the main focal point for demonstrations in the South during the summer of 1964. This, I'm 100% certain.
Unless this change takes place.
I think at this point, there would have to be a radical change. We negotiated for about 2 years, and we desegregated to Lunch Counter. We got some jobs for Negroes on Canal Street and in other areas. And we got some jobs in government, very insignificant jobs, nonetheless jobs. This was a start. This was to see how much and how fast a community could absorb change. But then the other side went to sleep, mainly the city government. So at this point, grievances are so high there's just no doubt. I personally don't want to negotiate anymore. I have no desire whatever. At no time, if I'm called by the persons I had talked with before, I'll tell them I'm no longer in. I've devoted my time to court fights and to voter registration, and of course to giving the demonstrators whatever support I can.
Do you know anything about the Baton Rouge Biracial Committee that's working?
I know the man who was chiefly responsible for it. It's a man by the name of Wade Mackey, who is a Quaker. As a matter of fact, he's in charge of the American Friends Service Committee in the state of Louisiana. He's their executive director. he was the guiding hand. He and a guy by the name of W, who is a state senator. Just as an aside, I'd like to state that W was a state senator. He was defeated because of his liberal views. He's on the Civil Rights Commission. And this man was reelected. He defeated Wendell Harris, who was one of the Governor Davis's chief henchmen. And I consider this to be the most significant race in the state of Louisiana, but he is now a state senator. Well, it was these two men, but mainly Wade Mack. He was a very, very great man who started this. I've discussed it with Wade. And this, as you know, came about only after demonstrations, 1,500 kids in the street, the fire hoses and the dogs and all of this. But Wade Mackey was able to prevail upon, again, the power structure to do something. Now, they've only succeeded thus far in desegregating the lunch counters.
I heard the other day in Baton Rouge that they have agreed to admit Negro doctors to practice in the Baton Rouge hospitals.
This is probably true, but I cannot state it as a fact.
I thought responsible source, but not from a member of the committee.
Well, Ronnie Moe could have answered that question.
I didn't think about it at the time. We were pressed for time.
By the time I could answer that question for you in a letter, if you just phone me, I will know, because I will see Wade Mackey this Wednesday. He will be coming down to spend a few days. He's very active with the American Civil Liberties Union, too, of which I'm a member. But Wade Mack is the man who's...
He would know what has actually been achieved.
Oh, no question about it. He knows more about it than any other individual.
If you find substantial, even though slow, progress like that, so long as there's motion, how would that modify your views of yesterday? Or would it modify them? I wasn't quite sure, you see. We were interrupted at the point we were coming to what seemed to be a fatalistic a view on your part that there would be no solution in terms of negotiation, in terms of even a social process depending on, quotes, some goodwill.
I certainly dislike having to have the attitude that I have in many instances on this question. But I'd be less than honest if I said that I don't possess this attitude, and because I don't believe, for example, that these kind of changes, if you say, so long as there's motion. I think this is doing nothing to change the basic problem. I think from the viewpoint of our gaining momentum, some changes helps our side, but frankly speaking, I think it does harm to the white side in a sense. In the sense of the what it does, really, it just means that Negroes, it's getting a little taste of freedom, so to speak. And it just makes them just push that much harder. I think Atlanta, Georgia is a good example of this.
Well, that is always the case, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That gains mean acceleration,
right.
Desires.
Right, right.
And gains also mean increased powers of organization.
Right. This is exactly what I'm saying. But it doesn't mean, gains does not mean that, it means that people become less satisfied and not more satisfied.
Right, right.
Which means that my fatalistic attitude toward this thing certainly isn't changed. What I'm suggesting is this, plain and simple. At what point or when is it possible for white people to look at black people as being human beings? I don't mean an individual white person. I mean as a whole. I read the other day, this happened in the Belgian Congo, and again, the problem is the same all over. There was this African, I don't know what went on between these people, but there's a pictures of it. And there's a white woman, and she pushes this guy. I don't know what happened, but he slugs her. And then the policeman comes and he moves him.
This in South Africa?
This is in the Belgian Congo.
In the Congo.
But what I'm suggesting is, you know what existed in the Belgian Congo in the past, you see. And in hearing people who are really of goodwill discuss this thing, it's difficult for me to believe that there's going to be any, that white people are going to be able to look at colored people as being human.
But can you distinguish between looking at colored people as being human, mm-hmm. and workable arrangements which move in the direction of justice?
Well,
increasing, an accelerating movement toward that. Say jobs, say schools, say votes, whether regarded as human or not, but the process of actual practical amelioration, practical adjustments.
Doesn't that move
toward the recognition?
Oh, sure. I don't deny that for 1 minute. And this is why I'm a member of CORE and not a member of the Black Muslims. Because I believe that. I believe that all of these things here, you do these things with the hope that, well, and this has always been true of Negroes, well, if I accomplish this, if I do that, then these people are going to realize that I'm human. Maybe they will, you see. But these things, these minor things, let's face it, this is the 20th century. We're talking about a people that has been on this continent for over 400 years, and there haven't been a recognition today. So these slow steps, but significant steps, I'm afraid that at times they mean a lot more to the Negro, or they mean different things to the Negro than what they mean to his white counterpart. It doesn't mean the same thing.
Right.
See, and this can be a big problem.
I'm certain you're right about the fact that it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing.
Right.
But be that as it may, would or would not just this process lead toward the human recognition?
Maybe so and maybe not. Because you see, if you start out 10 miles ahead of me, let's put it this way. If you start out with 10 times as much as I have, and you constantly give me a little more than I started with, but you constantly get a little more than you started with, and proportionately, you're getting a little more, you're getting about, the proportion remains the same, you see, then the space is still the same. I made this statement just then. This I think should be understood. I think that a large part of this thing has to be the Negro himself, his mind, you see. Certainly, I don't kid myself. There are certain things that Negroes haven't recognized. There are certain Negroes who are not convinced that they're human. You see, there are Negroes who see nothing wrong with going into a store and not seeing Negroes working. Or going into a store and they can't sit at this lunch counter, but they can spend all their money at this counter. You see, there are people who don't see anything wrong with this.
You mean the basic lack of self-respect, racial self-respect, or human self-respect either?
Human self-respect. This is what I mean.
I'm distinguishing those two things.
Right. I'm talking about human self-respect. Yes. Racial self-respect is something altogether, was something somewhat different.
May I cut back to the question of black Muslims? Mm-hmm. I remember your remarks of yesterday about them. Mm-hmm. Now, on one hand, they are a withdrawal, represented withdrawal from white society. The emphasis on the nationalistic, the black nationalistic aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And looking forward to a totally separate society. Mm-hmm. Now, in Essien Udem's book on the black Muslims, a very, very fascinating book, by the way, he says that the concealed motivation in the movement, or certainly one of the powerful motivations in it, which is concealed, is the drive toward the life of and values of the American middle class. That the program of self-betterment, moral and practical, which has been so successful with the black Muslims, means the acceptance of these values as a channel for the aspirations of people who have been hopeless about entering, quote, respectability. Is that channel toward respectability? So instead of being actually a withdrawal from the values of the American middle class, it's a secret movement toward the values of the American middle class. Therefore, in the movement, there is a paradox, a contradiction. Does that make any sense to you?
It makes an awful lot of sense. Unfortunately, I did not read the book. And I'm not sure it's the kind of a passage that I'm prepared to comment on, because this is...
Yes.
This is not a... This is really a lot more than a surface analysis. This is something I'd like to keep to think about.
Yes. Well, his point was you have the surface appeals, and then you have certain hidden appeals,
right.
And they're contradictory, or at least to a degree they're contradictory.
I don't think that they are contradictory, because if I say that you have something good, but you're not going to share it with me, you see. So I can't share this with you, so I'll develop it for myself.
Yes.
I don't know that this is anything contradictory. We're saying I don't want to associate with white people, but I know some of the things they do I want to adopt. I want to adopt their health habits, for example. And this, I don't see anything contradictory.
No, there's no contradiction at the level of the minute technical, whether it's habits or ice boxes.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though I don't want to assert this, that more is involved in his statement, that not only the techniques and objects and habits of the middle class, but also an inevitable absorption of values. This becomes a way of moving into the middle class society.
In other words,
the values absorbed too, along with the techniques and the habits.
In other words, what he's saying then is that if the Muslims are going to be completely separate, then they must do as the American Indians, become complete isolationists, maintain their own values. For example, one of the things that white America prides itself on is this bit about one man and one wife, which is somewhat nonsensical, and no one really, you know, believes in it. So the Muslims, they accept this value, whereby in the Muslim countries, you know, this, you know, if you can afford a harem, get one. I don't think if this is what he's saying, I don't think that this has nothing to do with the fact that this is white, the way of the whites. It's more that, you know, they live in a country where they can't do nothing else. See, the big problem with the black Muslims, ultimately, is that they have not. The whole thing have not been well thought out, because no matter how you attempt to analyze it, they have no wealth. And they don't have any program by which they could possibly hope to acquire any wealth, and they're bound in. It's impossible, for example, for me to be anything but an American, whether I like it or not. And this is true with the Muslims. This is true with Malcolm X. This is true with Elijah Muhammad. This is true with all of these people. And this is one of the problems of the Negro. For example, the Puerto Rican in New York is gradually getting much more wealth than the Negro. Why? Mainly because he has not adopted and lived with American values. Whether we like it or not, the value of the American is to, even if he's a porter, to try to go to a nice restaurant at times, wear nice clothes, get a nice car. This is it. The Puerto Rican, this hasn't been the value of the poor Puerto Rican in his country, you see? So what I'm trying to say is the Muslims are so bound up in America until it's impossible. This guy says he's a Muslim, and I've seen this in Harlem. A guy standing on the corner, he's a big Muslim, and that Monday morning he's going down in the government center and he's going to work for a white man. Here are the contradictions to me. So I don't know whether I really understand what this man is trying to say.
Well, he doesn't develop it at great length, mm-hmm. but certainly you have explored it, mm-hmm. and possibilities of it. One thing that crossed my mind in relation to what he said, let me cut back to explain the quotation of the reference we're talking about, Mr. Douglas. This is a paragraph or passage from Etienne Oudin's book on the black Muslims, which he points out what he considers to be a fact, that on one hand you have the withdrawal of the black nationalism, the attempt to set up new values that are opposed to American middle class values, you know. But on the other hand, he says, the drive toward rehabilitation, toward habits of thrift, health, and all of that, means a drive toward the American middle class values. And the concealed motive of black Muslim movement is to, the concealed appeal is to move toward American middle class values. Therefore, ultimately, is a movement toward integration rather than away from white society. It's somehow the middle class values are absorbed along with middle class techniques. That's his notion, as I take it to be.
Oh, I'd like to make a further comment on that. Oftentimes I've heard people say that what the Negro wants is to be accepted by white people. And I think the more enlightened people say that what the Negro wants is a contract with white people.
Contract?
A contract. A contract in the sense that we both have something to offer, whereby acceptance might imply that I have nothing to share with you, but everything you have, you know, I'm coming to take a part of, and hence the resistance. Therefore, certainly this is Coase philosophy. We have something to share. We have some things that would be beneficial to you. You have some things that would be beneficial to us. Therefore, we can enter into this contract. We can, you know, live here together. Now, I think maybe what this man, the author, I can't think of his name, is saying here, if it's valid, is that the Muslims are saying, well, let's develop something, you know. I don't think they're saying, let's wake up so we are like white people, and then they won't have any reason not to accept us. I think they're trying to develop something. That's something really very vague, and no one has really been very profound in attempting to express it. But I don't think that, I think the implication of what this man is saying is that these people are seeking acceptance, and I don't think this is true. I don't know if that makes sense.
It's making sense. He didn't say that they are seeking it. He said that they are unconsciously seeking it. Put it that way. It's an unconscious drive, the concealed appeal of the movement.
My initial impression, just off the top of my head, without having attempted to analyze it at length, is that, first of all, this is the black Muslims, or the black Muslim type of thing, is not unprecedented in America. You've had a black Muslim kind of thinking with Marcus Garvey, I believe. Initially, the motivating force, I would imagine, would be some person who has the wherewithal and enough ability to use a psychological or economic situation to achieve his own individualistic goal. On the tape that was, the thought that I'm trying to get across is that I've said at one time or other that Kennedy was not the person that his image was made out to be. In other words, I'm saying he agitated for civil rights, and in a sense, Elijah Muhammad is agitating in a different direction for their own individual goals. But this is only a small part of the situation. I've mentioned at one time or other the business of core with action and reaction. Here Elijah, or here Kennedy, sets out a certain action in the community, and of course, unless there's a response, positively or negatively, then his idea goes for naught. The real substance of what the black Muslims think would be evidenced best by, to me, by those people who form the real run-of-the-mill membership of the Muslim movement.
Let me ask you another question about them before we push on. Why Muslims? Why this reference to a Mohammedan world? Why not, what's the appeal in that?
I would say it was...
It doesn't belong to the tradition.
It doesn't matter what you call it. If the response is the kind of response that you want to get.
Well, I think it's this, you see. Again, it's tied in with the Negro being red in this American society. The Mau Maus, they did not have to use the Mohammedism. They could attach it some significance to nature, something mysterious. Now, all religions have to have something that's mysterious. For example, I've always thought it was nonsense for anyone to tell me that the Pope is the son of God or some descendant. That's absolute nonsense. He's a good politician. He got himself elected, just in the same sense that Kennedy got himself elected. So, but you have this mysticism, you see. So, the American Negro, they had to bring something that was a mystic to him, that was a mystery to him. So you talk about Mohammedism. It's a way out, so to speak. There was nothing in America that you could have built this, attach any supernatural significance to, that would not have been identified with white.
In other words, the Christian religion would not serve.
Oh, the Christian religion could never serve it. This is the real failure of many centuries. And I'll go to church tomorrow morning. I'm Methodist. I'll go for my own personal reasons, I suppose, but. This is the failure. This is what the Muslims, they may think that they are fighting the white American, or white people in an international sense. Well, they're really fighting is Christianity, and they are right. The church supported slavery, the church supports segregation, and we have discussed this. When the segregationist, this woman, Mrs. Gilliard, when she says to the Archbishop, well, Archbishop, you are telling me now that segregation is sinful. Where have the church been? Even today there are churches where Negroes have to sit in the back. So, when did it become sinful? Is it something that was always sinful, Father? Or is it something that just got sinful since 1954? And these people are right when they ask that question. The biggest hypocrites in the world have been the Christians. This is true with the Baptists. Some kids and friends of mine went to sit in a Baptist church, the big Reverend J.D. Gray, and he says, go where you want it. This is a Christian church. You know, in Christ there's no East and West, and it's, you know. So I think if there's anything, I agree with the Muslims insofar as they say the Negro should reject Christianity. Man, this is going to get us no place. You know, all this means is turning the other cheek. And as we were talking, and someone said that the priests in the white church tell the white kids to slap the Negroes, and the priests in the colored church tell them to turn the other cheek. I don't think that the Muslims could possibly, I mean, have predicated their movement on Christianity. They had to be anti-Christian. This was the ABCs of it. Without this, there would have been no possible chance. Because remember, look at the mind the Muslims are trying to appeal to. They are appealing to people that they have to show it to them. Now look at these sins. And believe me, you can never win an argument with the Muslims with the Muslim on the race question. The evidence is that high in its favor. I could show that Christianity had failed me as a Negro. And I would minister.
Well, let's bring it down to New Orleans in a sense, Lois. My opinion is that the balance in the segregation versus integration bit in New Orleans, particularly because of the fact we have such a substantial number of Catholics, both Negro and white, lies within the power of the Catholic Church. And until now, I'm speaking about Catholics, we've only given obeisance verbally to the moral mandate.
Are you a Catholic?
Well, I don't fall within a strict category of Catholic. I guess if you throw me in or out on the basis of tenets, I'd have to say no. I was baptized, I went to Catholic grammar school and high school, but
Catholic law school.
In a Catholic law school, but it's not satisfying to me.
He hasn't been to church in many years, that's what he's saying. On the other hand, I go to church every Sunday, I want you to know that.
But the Methodist church.
Right. Wouldn't make any difference. I don't see any difference in that position. So I go to Methodist Church because of my wife was Methodist and my father was Catholic, my mother was Baptist, and we agreed that whatever religion church I joined, she would join. And I didn't used to go to church, and my wife and I would have an argument every Sunday morning. It was about the only thing we argued about, so I said, well, there's no sense in me arguing with my wife. It makes her happy. I'll go to church.
Of course, there's a real reason why I don't go to church, because the symbolism which is used in churches, particularly in the Catholic Church, has been, the focus has been so much on symbolism that persons who are baptized and born and educated in the church, by and large, don't recognize what the purpose of the church is, and the symbolism has lost all its original purpose. And I can communicate to whoever is responsible for our being here on a person-to-person basis, at my convenience, as well as I can anywhere else. So I feel that in making the most of whatever it is I have to offer is as much that I can do as against the person who feels that when he doesn't eat meat on Friday, he has fulfilled his obligation as a Catholic for that particular day.
Mr. Douglas, I've been reading those very interesting essays you gave me. And I have a question or two that stem from that reading. In one of your pieces, you say that the fact that the New Orleans Negro population, as opposed to community, I'm getting at, the fact that it's dispersed, that there's no way to refer to a Negro community in a geographical sense. You say this, or imply that this, has been a liability in New Orleans, this dispersal, this geographical dispersal of the Negro community. Now, would it seem to some people anyway that this dispersal would actually make for absorption into general society, make for integration, rather than work against it? What is the relation to school attendance, in relation to the ghetto problem altogether, you see?
I don't think that... Well, let me put it this way. Built into my position of necessity is a series of contradictions. However, when I said that the fact that Negroes are scattered throughout the city might have a deleterious effect on any constructive work that we might do, what I meant a little more specifically was that, and I think Murdaugh makes reference to it, is the fact that we've had a matriarchal family set up. And so the dispersal goes even further than geographically. What I had in mind was a situation where, in order to contribute something of a substantial nature to any community, one has to learn how to work with other people. And of course, if your family is broken up, you can't do this because this is the starting point. Brothers and sisters work together, and fathers, parents assist. And so to fit it into the geographical situation, there is a certain kind of togetherness that can occur with Negroes who have a peculiar problem. You can't expect initially other people to be sympathetic or to assist you in whatever ways they feel they should assist you unless they feel that you are, first of all, making an attempt to help yourself.
This would sound like, I'm not saying that this is what I got out of it, but it can be said that this would lead to the statement attributing to you that to break out of the ghetto, you need a bigger and better ghetto, a concentrated ghetto, in order to motivate the force of the breakout of the ghetto, the forces toward an integrated and free society. Perhaps I'd better try this for a second to see if we really get it really back in business. You're a long way from this.
You gotta come up closer. Maybe you better get
We met yesterday.
Incidentally, Bob is Catholic, though.
Beg pardon?
Bob is Catholic.
Oh, you're the Catholic man with the firm, are you?
Yes, I think so. Sometimes these guys try to convince me that I'm not a Catholic, really.
It just goes to show you how tolerant I am. You see, I even consider Catholics to be human beings, you see.
Well, I consider some of them to be.
Mainly because of my fault. I'd have to admit something about myself to deny it.
You mentioned Myrdal a moment ago. Let's look back for a moment at his view of the Reconstruction of the South after the Civil War. He laid down what he would consider the ideal program for that period, what would have worked, and it would have avoided our later difficulties. As I remember it, it's something like this. There would have been compensation to slaveholders. There would have been expropriation of land, but payment for land that was expropriated. There would have been a distribution of land to the ex-slaves, but on a purchase basis, at a very, very low price, and the debt to be amortized over a very long period of time. But at least to make this a purchase and not a free gift, so it's for obvious line of argument there. There would have been supervision of land for a while, so that no sales could have been made of persons who undertook the burden of ownership. They couldn't have been exploited by sharpers. That there would have been, of course, educational program for both Negroes and whites, and a resettlement of Negroes on Western land and elsewhere, a dispersal from the Southern concentration, with some attempt to supervise industries or farming to new conditions that they would confront on this. Does that make sense?
Well, my immediate response to that is that I've retained enough of the give and take of the American democratic system to be against any situation where, and I recognize the fact that I subject myself to criticism for this kind of statement, particularly when some of the civil rights people are urging that a preferential treatment be given to Negroes. I don't believe in giving away anything to anybody, anything material, that is. And I think artificial means of compensating for things which have had a bad effect on us in the past are not a real substitute, because the people in power are going to eventually, and perhaps sooner, find a way to get this from you unless you know how to protect it. What I'm attempting to say is this. If the law is administered fairly, and if persons are given an opportunity to compete on the basis of your individual merit, then you don't need an artificial situation. Now you can have your chance to talk.
What are you doing?
Go ahead.
Well, I can't agree. Now we're talking about you're talking about equal chance to compete. You're talking about some people that had just been let out of bondage, and there was nowhere in hell for them to compete. I think that perhaps Murdoch has something, except that I'm reminded that you're evaluating this in terms of something that has failed. What was tried during Reconstruction, in a sense, has failed. So he has another theory.
Nothing was really tried. It was a drift, really.
Right. Well, that's true. But what I'm saying is,
I don't think you can argue with the proposition that if given an equal chance to compete, you can't. Anybody who's born in a situation like this is very little more that you can add.
Yeah, but you're talking about today. Given an equal chance, you're a lawyer. He's a lawyer. You have an equal chance. You can do all right. But now you're talking now about a group of people who are illiterate, and you're saying you want to just give them a chance to compete with the people that have been educated and the people who were running the country? What the hell good is an equal chance?
Well, of course, I think the entire question you seem to indicate, Lois, in your when you prefaced your last remark, that perhaps the question is somewhat academic. However, I think it's very practical for this reason, that in your later remarks, I think you did then perhaps realize that it does have meaning. Perhaps there's some germ of truth in what Myrtle said was the solution then for the solution now. And it's especially in the point of dispersal, this kind of thing.
I'm not denying that. There's nothing that I said that's inconsistent with what you said.
Yes, you were saying, Mr. Collins, I'm getting you on the tape, your name on the tape now. You're saying, Mr. Collins, then, that the fact of Myrdal's scheme has concealed reference to the present.
Correct. I think he, of course, realized that he was speculating on what would have worked then. But I think that he must have had, and I think he did have, a practical reference for the future, that is, as to what could be done.
I find this notion coming up now and then. Someone will say, I think Myrdal is right except for number one, compensation to slaveholders, you see. Or say, I think Myrdal is right except for number two, compensation to the landholders for expropriated land.
Well, I think this is the same situation that exists when you enter in a compromise of a lawsuit. The guys generally ask for more than they expect to get, and whatever you get is the same kind of situation where the people presently say, "Well, we will accept points 3, 4, and 5 of Myrdal, but." We don't go along with 1 and 2.
Well, my interest is this. In finding the motivations, you see, of a person who would say, I accept all of this would have been a good idea, because it's long since passed, the possibility, or it would have been a bad idea, or I resist accepting part of this program, even in this retroactive way, that this is something I think can be told by how one responds to the Myrdal's program, even his hypothetical ground, having reference to a past situation. The other thing, of course, is what does it imply about the spirit of an arrangement for the present, if not the details, of course. The details have to be very different.
But I think the two requirements that I've outlined would apply theoretically both to the Civil War period then and to the period now. This is all that I ask personally, is an opportunity to compete. I don't want anybody to give me anything, and I think this is a part of the whole civil rights movement. We're not asking the majority race to give us something. We're only asking that we be accorded the same basic rights and opportunities which have been accorded to the white people for the very same reason.
Mr. Eli, you... I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I caught a falling inflection. I'm sorry.
Our chief complaint about the administration of justice and about the legislative setup in the South now is that legislatively, the entire panoply of state government, city government, and whatever other kinds of governments you have, is thrown into the balance against the Negroes. And I think a substantial step forward will be made when we get some semblance of fairness and treatment, not only in the civil rights cases, but in your criminal cases and also in your civil cases. This system of segregation is so invidious that it permeates unconsciously the minds of a judge when he decides what is the money value of a Negro child who's been killed wrongfully in an automobile accident. And this is one of the many, many, many instances of how we've been shortchanged. And the classic answer is that there's no one way to solve the problem, but it's a buckshot approach from all angles and get whatever you can while you can get it.
Have any of you ever found yourself discriminated against, you think, from the bench?
I think we could best answer that by telling you, what is that clipping about Judge Rarick?
we tried civil rights cases, and I think you could arrive at your own conclusion. We represent Core. We've been going up to Clinton, Louisiana, for many months now, about 9 months, I suppose. And the judge before whom we try these cases, we learned only this week that he's a director of the Louisiana Citizens Council. I don't think it takes much imagination to realize that we've experienced discrimination from the bench. Now, let me say this. When you say the bench, if you mean if I'm representing a person before Judge X, will I get the same thing that a white lawyer would have gotten had he been representing him? I'd say no, the answer is no, because the judges don't discriminate because I'm a Negro. They're going to discriminate, it's going to be because the client is a Negro. And if he's represented by a white lawyer, it isn't going to do him any very much good.
Lawless, I think that we've experienced discrimination in both ways. Because I can think of one very good example of a case in which there were Negroes on both sides. But I think that we had a prejudiced judge who was prejudiced against us as Negro lawyers. It's something that you don't like to admit.
The Jones case?
Yeah, it's something that you don't like to admit, frankly speaking. It's something that a lawyer finds very difficult to admit to a client. Because really, it puts you out of competition in the market for the... in other words, we have less to sell if we can't get for our clients the same thing or more than anyone else. And frankly speaking, we don't have the practice as Negro lawyers that we should have. We would like to think that Negroes would discriminate in our favor in giving us their business, not only because of this perhaps false notion of race pride, but also because of the fact that we can do more for them, or just as much, anyway, to put it on an equalitarian basis, just as much as any other lawyer. Now certainly, I feel that I'm as qualified as any other member of the bar, any other average member of the bar. There's certainly some that I feel are more qualified than me because of their age or their experience and opportunity. But certainly, we feel that we represent in this office a cross-section of the Bar Association of the City of New Orleans or the State of Louisiana, that we can represent our clients as well as anyone else. And in most situations, we don't feel that we have any problems, but we have had examples, certainly. Now, some Jewish lawyer might be able to make the same comment, or maybe some Italian lawyer might be able to make that comment before an Irish judge. Maybe this Irish judge doesn't like Italian. So it may be that the discrimination that we have experienced as Negroes is no more in this particular situation, because at times we suspect that maybe we are discriminated in favor of with reference to certain judges. Certain judges might give us a break because of the fact that they feel that perhaps we need some extra help.
May I comment on this? We, particularly when we've been involved in the civil rights cases, have had occasions to discuss with the judges and with the district attorneys certain phases of the case. And on more than one occasion, we have been blatantly told that and I believe the man was sincere when he said it, although I thought he was wrong. He said, "I lean over backwards to help the Negro. When he should get 3 years, I give him 1 year. When he should get 1 year, I give him a suspended sentence." And this is exactly what I mean when I said earlier, I don't want anybody to do any favors for me. If I'm wrong, then say I'm wrong. But the important thing to me is when I'm right, I want to be right. And don't you see that this ties in with the essence of justice? Because if a person is given wrong when in essence he's right, then this strikes at the core of everything that this man lives by. Right and wrong become intermingled and mixed up, and it really doesn't matter whether you're on the right side of the fence or the wrong side of the fence, because you're going to be given wrong anyhow. So then, and this ties up with the temper of the movement. The Negroes feel that, well, why not boycott? We don't have anything to lose. I don't have any money invested in the store. And the white people are beginning to realize that I have money invested in the stores, and the Negroes are not as satisfied as I thought they were. And the white people are going to stop coming around if the stores are being boycotted, and they're being pinched in situations where they've never felt the pinch of the dollar before. And maybe this is a fortunate thing. The bad publicity scares off incoming industry. And again, you have a pinch, not on an individual basis, but on a citywide basis, or perhaps even a statewide basis.
Reverend Abernathy told me that they have had great success in their selected boycotts in Atlanta. And on a job basis, they hadn't failed yet to get results. I should change this now, pick up the next tape.